Today is Tuesday, December the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Republicans release a rebuttal to what is likely to be a scathing report recommending the president's impeachment.
It appears that this was a case of bribery, and bribery is explicitly an impeachable offense in the Constitution.
As world leaders meet at a crucial climate summit in Madrid, there seems to be a clash between science, the public, and political will. Also ahead, a song by the late Prince has been released after 37 years. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic lawmakers in Congress will take a big step this week in what appears now to be an inexorable march toward impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump, with the start of hearings seen as a precursor to formal charges being announced within weeks. The House Judiciary panel will hear public testimony from four legal scholars on what constitutional basis a U.S. president can be removed from office. The committee will also receive a report from the House Intelligence Committee laying out the evidence the Democrats say shows Trump abused his office for personal political gain. Democrats have been looking into the Republican president's efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden, former Democratic vice president who is now seeking his party's nomination to face Trump in the 2020 presidential election, as well as Biden's son, Hunter, who was a board member of a Ukrainian energy company. Trump has denied any wrongdoing and says that a July 25th phone call with President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which he pressed for the probes, was perfect. Earlier today, without evidence, though, Trump said Ukraine's leader said he did nothing wrong.
If you notice, there was breaking news today. The Ukrainian president came out and said very strongly that President Trump did absolutely nothing wrong. That should be case over.
In a defiant response Sunday night, the White House also informed Democrats Trump and his lawyers will not participate in Wednesday's hearings, citing a lack of fundamental fairness. Joining us now is Joel Paul, professor of UC Hastings Law School, who specializes in congressional and constitutional law. What is your assessment of what we've heard so far from the news and public hearings?
I think the kinds of witnesses that have presented testimony to this date would be very persuasive in any court of law. It's hard for me to imagine that most juries would acquit someone after hearing the kind of testimony that was presented so far. But I think that the issue here, which the president has not yet addressed and Republicans need to address if they're going to defend the president effectively, is to try to explain what the motive was holding up the military assistance for Ukraine. That's really the central issue. But for that, it appears that this was a case of bribery, and bribery is explicitly an impeachable offense in the Constitution.
What about the argument that Republicans are making that the president was fighting corruption?
If the president was fighting corruption, there's no other evidence that he was interested in any other corruption. There's also the fact that we have seen decisions to withhold the aid, his phone call to the president of Ukraine, and then subsequently the decision to release the aid only after the whistleblower's report reached the president. So the president knew at the time that he decided to release the aid that it was about to become a public issue, and he was under intense pressure from members of Congress. So it would seem that for all of those reasons, there was an intent here to solicit a bribe from Ukraine. The fact that the president knew about the whistleblower's report before the public did, and that he subsequently, within a matter of, I think, 24 hours, decided to release the aid, suggests that the president was caught red-handed in trying to extort from Ukraine help in his election.
The Republicans and the president have been claiming that this is a Democratic hoax, that this is just, an unfair process altogether, that they haven't allowed them to have their own people testifying, their own witnesses, and it's been unfair to the president. And now the Jerry Nadler, ahead of the upcoming Judiciary Committee hearing this week, invited the president and any other witnesses that they would like, and they declined to participate. Why?
I think, first of all, the reason that the president was not invited to participate in the Intelligence Committee hearing was that that was simply a matter of them gathering information prior to an impeachment, which is akin to an indictment. In a typical legal situation, a defendant would not have an attorney to argue his case until the case actually went to trial, not at the impeachment stage, not before a grand jury. So that's why there was no involvement of the president's lawyers at that stage. At this point, there has been so much criticism from Republicans, the House Judiciary Committee opened the door to the president's attorney coming in. Really, there was no purpose in his coming. The conversation before the impeachment committee is likely to be at a fairly high level of generality, discussing the question of what constitutes an impeachable offense. Personally, I don't think there's any question at this point that bribery is an impeachable offense. And so most of this is going to go to the further questions as to whether the president obstructed Congress, whether that's an impeachable offense, whether he abused his power, or whether he also may have obstructed the legal process in connection with the Mueller investigation. And so those kinds of legal issues are questions which are not going to be about the specific facts or the evidence case so much as whether certain kinds of actions constitute impeachable offenses under the Constitution. Those are questions of constitutional law. The president apparently felt that sending his attorneys to the Judiciary Committee hearing at this stage would only look like he was legitimating the process. And frankly, I don't know that his attorneys could have done much good because of the nature of the kinds of questions that the impeachment committee will be talking about, which are not really about the facts of the case, but rather what kinds of abuses constitute impeachable offenses under the Constitution.
And this week we enter a new stage of this whole inquiry with the House Judiciary Committee now holding hearings. What is different about this?
Well, the Judiciary Committee's role is really to draw up articles of impeachment. It seems likely that there will be at least one article of impeachment alleging bribery, which is explicitly a crime under the Constitution that is impeachable. And there will also probably be at least one, possibly two other articles for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, that is, president's refusal to allow members of the executive branch to appear before Congress and give testimony as requested. And then in addition to that, there's another issue which has not yet been resolved by the Democratic leadership as to whether the Judiciary Committee would also consider a charge of obstruction of justice based on the president's refusal to cooperate with the Mueller investigation.
All right, that's Joel Paul, professor at UC Hastings Law School. He specializes in congressional and constitutional law. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, the world must choose hope over surrender in the fight against climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Monday, warning a summit in Madrid that governments risk sleepwalking past the point of no return.
We must finally demonstrate that we are serious in our commitment to stop the war against nature, that we have the political will to reach carbon neutrality by 2050.
The latest round of annual negotiations to bolster the 2015 Paris Agreement to curb global warming comes amid stark warnings that soon it may be too late to prevent catastrophic consequences of global warming. Amid the backdrop of unusually severe weather disasters this year, from fires in the Arctic and Amazon in Australia to intense tropical hurricanes. Joining us is Stephen Lewandowski, a scientist and professor at the University of Bristol, who will be leading a panel this week at the summit in Madrid. Thank you for being with us. There seems to be a clash between the warnings that emissions are going up, not down, when they need to go down, young people outside of the summit protesting and demanding action, and then the politicians that are tasked with making the changes.
There is a major gap between the political reality and the physical reality. And I think it's going to be difficult, but not impossible, to reduce that gap.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres said there's also a real gap between the world's major emitters and those that will suffer the most because of it. And those people that are the most emitters really need to step up. It doesn't seem like that's happening. And of course, we know the United States is not leading the way.
No, on the contrary, I think the U.S. is in the impediment to progress at the moment, unfortunately, yeah.
Would you say that's because the U.S. president has pulled out of the climate accord and has actually started the actual process of doing that?
That's the most obvious manifestation of that. But I think, you know, there's a lot more stuff domestically that's going on, you know, such as the undermining of the independence of the EPA and all sorts of appointments within the U.S. government into key positions of people who are beholden to commercial interests, to say the least, and who are not supporting the scientific consensus on climate change.
And under the existing pledges, will the world continue to be on course for the kind of temperature rises that are threatening the stability of these very societies they're trying to bolster?
Number one, we're on a very dangerous trajectory. Number two, the progress in terms of technology and the potential to replace fossil fuels is actually considerable. So we're sort of doing the bad things politically while ignoring good things that we could do technologically, which is unfortunate to say the least and bizarre. But the good news is if we ever do get serious about it, then I think we can move surprisingly quickly.
When you say if we ever do,
I think we just need to achieve a global political consensus on this, and that has to include the United States, because the United States is a major emitter, and we need concerted policy action on that. And I think at the moment the difficulty is that everybody is sort of waiting for everybody else, mm-hmm. and no one feels that they should move ahead, and they're all pointing the finger at each other. So we have an impasse that has to be broken.
UN chief saying we're getting closer to the point of no return. When you hear things like that, you get pretty scared.
Undoubtedly, there are reasons to be very concerned, and we do know that complex systems contain nasty surprises. And whether you're talking about climate change or anything else that's hyper-complex, once you start poking it with a stick, the outcome is never good, because it can contain unanticipated tipping points and feedback loops and all sorts of things.
We mentioned the president. He and his administration, the people that he seems to be, as you mentioned, bringing into these agencies that are tasked with protecting the planet, he just denies the science, and it doesn't really matter what the scientists say. People are taken aback by that.
Sure.
Wondering how you can get to that point where you just don't believe the consensus, yeah. the science, etc. And you're actually speaking on this very topic at a panel. What is the answer to that? Why is this that people get to this point where they just don't believe?
Excellent question. That is precisely what we have to look at. We have to look at this in a broader context, because it isn't just climate denial. It is also the case that Donald Trump, according to fact checkers, has made more than 11,000 misleading or false statements since he took office. So why or how is it possible for that to happen and without there being a public backlash? I think that's the real question we have to understand. We think, on the basis of the available evidence, that the answer is that whenever people, a segment of the population, feels either disenfranchised or left behind or feels that the political system is not working in their favor, then they accept what we call a lying demagogue. That is, they're accepting people who pretend or proclaim to be acting on their behalf against the establishment. And once they feel that somebody is opposing the establishment, then any violation of establishment norms is seen as an asset rather than a problem. So one of the striking things about Donald Trump, and also in the UK, is the complete disregard for truth and the complete sort of insouciance when they get caught out. It's kind of like they don't even take notice of being caught out and just continue on in the same vein. They can only do that because that is signaling to their supporters that they're violating establishment norms and that therefore they're on the side of quote-unquote the real people against the establishment. So that is really the political situation that we have to understand. And I think that explains why Donald Trump keeps on making false statements. It explains why he can pull out of the climate accord and a lot of people don't care. It explains why a lot of people don't believe climate scientists, because scientists are part of the elite, quote unquote. And that is, I think, the problem we're encountering now.
So if governments or world leaders come across this situation where they're up against someone who just flat out says these things, that the scientists are the elite and they don't believe it, it's all about money and all these other arguments, how do governments counter that?
We're morally obligated to continue with fact-checking and anything else we can do to keep politicians accountable. But the solution to this problem is not more fact-checking. It's different politics. It is the recognition that there are lots of people out there who feel left behind, or, you know, not even economically left behind, but who feel that the government is no longer acting on their behalf or is representing them. In order to fix that, we have to fix the politics. Of course, the difficulty is that the people currently in power who benefit from this populism are the last people interested in fixing those politics. So we're kind of caught in a vicious spiral for that reason.
All right. Well, we appreciate your taking the time to discuss it with us. That's Stephen Lewandowski, scientist and professor with the University of Bristol. Meanwhile, top corporate executives and labor leaders from groups, including the heads of Apple, Tesla and the Royal Dutch Shell, Monday issued a public plea ahead of the climate summit for the U.S. to stay in the global pact, arguing that the battle against climate change would protect the nation's economy and create jobs and businesses. The Trump administration plans to pull the U.S., one of the world's biggest emitters of planet-warming greenhouse gases, out of the 2015 accord adopted by nearly 200 nations. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Amnesty International says at least 208 people have been killed in Iran's protest crackdown. Airstrikes in Syria have killed at least 20 people near a school and public market. U.S. ambassador is horrified by a sentence for a Zambia gay couple. And an aid group says gunmen have stormed its compound in South Sudan. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the families of two former University of Cambridge students fatally stabbed at the London Bridge on Friday are paying tribute to their lost loved ones and requesting privacy. Reuters reporter Jason Albano has more.
The families of the two people killed in London on Friday have released heartfelt tributes. Saskia Jones and Jack Merritt were fatally stabbed in an attack on London Bridge. They were involved in a prisoner rehabilitation conference, which their attacker had also been attending. The family of Jones said the 23-year-old had a wonderful thirst for knowledge and a great passion for providing invaluable support to victims of criminal injustice. Merritt's family described him as thoughtful and empathetic while working towards helping people in the criminal justice system. They also said the 25-year-old would not want the attack, quote, to be used as a pretext by the government for introducing even more draconian sentences on prisoners or for detaining people in prison for longer than necessary. The attacker, identified as Usman Khan, had been convicted of terrorism in 2012, but was let out early. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Sunday he would strengthen prison sentences and boost security in the wake of Friday's attack.
All right. Well, bystanders tackled the suspect, who then was shot and killed by police on the bridge. Prime Minister Johnson and his main opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn paused Monday to honour the two people killed and four others wounded before turning back to trading the blame for the security failings that allowed a man who had been jailed for terrorist crimes to go on this violent rampage in the heart of London. Johnson is now vowing to strengthen prison sentences and boost security. The pledge comes as Britain prepares for a general election on December 12th and hosts the annual NATO leaders meeting this week. My colleague Steve Miller asks London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell what the Prime Minister is saying to make his case to the public.
His line since that attack on Friday is that there are too many prisoners and too many terror suspects in particular being released automatically. And the debate around this attack has been politicized very, very quickly, to the dismay, I have to say, of the families of the victims. Boris Johnson is saying that under legislation that he says was introduced under previous governments before the Conservative government came in 2010, it means that some serious criminals are released early. So, for example, in the case of the attacker on Friday, Usman Khan, he was sentenced to 16 years in jail for his part in a plot to attack the London Stock Exchange in 2012, but he was released a year ago under license, which means that he was released from jail, but that he would be monitored by the police and by the security services. There were certain conditions of his release, people he wasn't allowed to be in contact with, places he wasn't allowed to go. But it seems despite the fact that he was being monitored, he was still able to carry out this attack.
You mentioned that this has been politicized. We are, of course, a little over a week away from the general election. What's been the reaction to those discussions across Britain ahead of that vote?
Well, I think there will be many people who will say that this has happened too quickly. Perhaps it is inevitable in an election season so close to the December the 12th polling date. That politicians will jump on this and will look at the policies that may have led to this. But I think the reaction of many people in the country that I've spoken to, many newspapers and commentators and so on, has been one that is critical of the politicians for doing this far too early.
Switching gears, U.S. President Donald Trump is now on his way to London for the NATO leaders' meeting. What can you tell us about what we can expect to see as these leaders for NATO gather in London?
There are two key themes, I think, underpinning this this meeting, and NATO is keen to say this is not a summit. I think they're downplaying it because of the tensions that are underlying it. The first one has been in existence for a long time, and of course it's something that President Trump has made a particular case of, and that's military spending among the United States' European allies. The second tension underlying this conference is over the war in Syria. And of course, the United States' pullout in October allowed Turkish forces to move in. There were nearly confrontations between Turkish and United States forces, and Turkish forces are now firing upon the Kurdish allies who helped the Western coalition defeat the Islamic State.
All right, that's London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking with my colleague, International Edition Steve Miller. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, for many Americans, the holiday season means shopping, and increasingly they are doing it online. The Cyber Monday, held each year on the Monday after the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, online retailers offer deep discounts in hopes of ramping up holiday sales. Many shoppers in the U.S. say they do a mix of online and in-person shopping to find the best deals. VOA's Michelle Quinn looked at this year's online shopping trends in the United States.
Holiday shopping in the United States can seem like an Olympic sport, hustling in and out of stores, scouring for deals, and more, shopping on computers, particularly on Cyber Monday, the first Monday after the U.S. Thanksgiving Day holiday. It's when online retailers offer eye-popping deals.
I think this Cyber Monday will see more and more sales. More and more people will kind of migrate to shopping online versus in-store.
In the U.S., nearly 20% of all holiday sales are expected to occur online this year. Still, many say buying stuff this way can be tedious. They miss the personal experience of being in a store, touching the object, talking to a salesperson.
I like to still go to stores and, you know, especially places like Macy's and Nordstrom and those big stores. It's nice to be able to talk to the helpers in the store and try different products, so it makes it enjoyable. Possibly even walk around with your girlfriends or your daughter.
I'd like a deal on a price. I'm not gonna lie about that, but like, just online shopping, I would prefer like actual shopping as opposed to online shopping in general.
For many shoppers, finding that right gift is often a mixture of looking both online and in person.
I feel like Cyber Monday, I get to be like removed from all the craziness, but I still get a really good deal.
Some retailers try to blend the online and in-person shopping experience. This store in San Francisco sells electronics and other products, but doubles as a showroom. If the shopper goes home and buys the product online from Amazon, that's okay. The store shares its data with the companies behind the products.
Each one of our stores has cameras up in the ceilings here. These collect anonymous overhead data. So this is basically just measuring bodies in a space.
Some stores, such as IKEA, the furniture seller, are using augmented reality so an online shopper can see what a chair might look like in their living room. Chatbots, pre-programmed online assistants, answer shoppers' questions.
It's not human, but they've been able to like emulate a human so well and provide so much information to that bot. It really gives the customer a very good experience.
For many shoppers, getting into the holiday spirit online is a challenge. But with a few clicks and the help of a chatbot, shoppers can get their shopping done so they can enjoy the holiday season. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Dictionary.com's word of the year is existential, the APZ Donahue reports.
Existential is an adjective affirming or implying the existence of a thing. The word has been brought up by people like teenage climate change activist Greta Thunberg.
We are now facing an existential crisis.
And Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden.
The president is literally an existential threat to America.
Dictionary.com says there were sustained searches for existential after these references, as well as in the aftermath of wildfires, Hurricane Dorian, and deadly mass shootings. Even Toy Story 4 character Forky sparked searches for existential.
I don't belong here!
John Kelly with Dictionary.com says searches for existential literally and figuratively speaks to the sense of grappling with our survival. I'm Ed Donahue.
After 37 years, a previously unreleased song by American singer, songwriter, musician, producer, dancer, and artist known as Prince is now available to the public. The song is called Purple Music. It had previously only been circulated underground in bootleg form. The song, which is 11 minutes long already, is getting rave reviews as one of Prince's funkiest songs ever, and as Rolling Stone calls it, 1999-era perfection. Prince, who died at the age of 57 in April of 2016 from an accidental overdose at his home in Minnesota, was considered a guitar virtuoso known for his falsetto singing voice, as well as his masterful integration of different genres like psychedelic, R&B, soul, funk, and pop, as well as his flamboyant stage appearances. Prince sold over 130 million records worldwide, making him one of the best-selling musical artists of all time. You've been listening to International Edition. That'll do it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA.